This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
And that's when I heard da, 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 in my head.
Therapy by Beyonce.
And Pepsi are still paying for it.
Too English, I think you find the word.
Creating an emotion around your product or service card or the execution.
Can I be the good one once?
It is Monday, the 26th of February, 2018, and welcome to the Simon Dell Show, episode number 17. 17 happens to be my lucky number. It's the one that I always bet on the roulette table. It's in my lottery numbers. Hasn't actually been particularly lucky for me ever, but there you go. So hopefully episode number 17 is going to be lucky. We have a lady by the name of Rachel Service, a Kiwi, who is the CEO of the Happiness Concierge. Now, she's based down in Melbourne. She is a whirlwind of a guest. She has got a huge amount to say, most of it very, very interesting as well. And hopefully you will take a lot of learnings out of it. Some of it gets quite deep at some points. We talk about the pressures of business and suicide as well, which is never a happy subject to talk about, but something that affects a lot of people in life and in business. So please listen in to her. She's absolutely entertaining, and check her out as well on her website, and you'll get all those details at the end. The second thing I've got to talk about is, for some unbeknown reason, as a total glutton for punishment, I've started a second podcast. And this one is about something that I'm passionate about on the side, which is cryptocurrency, which obviously everybody's talking about at the moment. You see it a lot in the news, absolutely everywhere, with Bitcoin and blockchain and all those kinds of things. So if you want to check that out, the episodes are actually only about 20 minutes long, so they're really good to listen to quickly. You will find them if you go into the iTunes store, the iTunes podcast store, and search for the words Crypto Conversations. It's myself and another English guy called Harvey Jones, who I used to play football with. We are talking about a different altcoin every week, and the show format is that I ask the stupid questions, and Harvey is clearly the one that's done the research and knows what he's talking about, which is pretty much my life in general. The third thing, Gilberto, I talk about him every week. He's the sound engineer. If you are looking to do your own podcast, please go and talk to Gilberto wherever you are in the world. If you fancy even just doing a demo, Gilberto will do that for $99. So welovesound.audio is the domain. Go and talk to Gilberto and he will help you out. The other usual things that we need to talk about, please donate if you want to keep us free of advertising, and God knows we want to keep this free of advertising. If you go to the show notes, you'll see some cryptocurrency donation addresses, so please send us what you can. Rate and review us on iTunes. If you can't write a review, please just give us some measure of stars. And if you would like to follow us on Instagram, we're going to post some stuff from the today's spin cycle on Instagram, some adverts that we talk about. So if you'd like to follow us on that, you can find us, The Simon Dell Show, on Instagram. And Eddie is back with a bang. She's put down the bong. No more hits from the bong. And we talk about some advertising campaigns that have riled us up over the past few weeks and months. Finally, come and talk to me, please. If you'd like to appear on the podcast, I did a shout out on LinkedIn the other week and got a huge response. So thank you very much to everybody who contacted me on LinkedIn. Please, if you've got an interesting story, if you're the CEO or a CMO, if you're a startup business, if you are just somebody that's interesting, we like interesting people. And if you think people could learn from your story, what you've achieved, those are the sort of people that we want to talk to. So please come and find me. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on LinkedIn. And if you do come and add me or want to follow me, then please say hello, because There's nothing stranger on LinkedIn than getting an invitation from someone you've got no idea who they are, and they add you on LinkedIn, and all of a sudden you're going, I don't know, is this someone who's listened to my podcast, or is this just some sort of weirdo stalker? So please tell me who you are, because I'd love to connect and I'd love to chat to you. So that's pretty much it from me. We will get into the spin cycle. Please enjoy yourself and enjoy the interview and enjoy the spin cycle. Welcome once again. It is another episode of the Spin Cycle, and joining me as usual this week is the Bitcoin of co-hosts, Dr. Edwina Luck from QUT, and the Monopoly Money of co-hosts, Channel 7's Patrick Condren. Welcome, people.
Monopoly Money? Really?
Hello.
That's it? Bitcoin fell through the floor.
I love it.
So
it's on its way back up. It's the future of money.
From the floor. Pat. It's not the future of money.
Absolutely.
It's the future of money, Pat.
The future of money will be a glass of water.
Do you think we're all going to go Mad Max, do you?
Absolutely. I can't wait.
That would be good.
You're going to be wholly unprepared for that, mate.
I'm going to have lots of water. I'm saving water.
Have you got your pigs?
We are going to talk tonight. Oh, what?
Well, Mad Max. They had the pigs under the city.
Did the police?
The pig. What? No. The four-legged ones who made the methane gas, who powered the city.
Oh. It's been a long time since I've seen that film.
Condellini wants his hand back is one thing that I remember.
No. Anyway, back to the point of this. Okay. We are going to talk about some of the favourite campaigns or least favourite campaigns that we've seen in the past few weeks. And I'm going to kick it off because I saw today the abomination that is the Nick Xenophon political ad. Well, I know we've spoken about politicians doing ads before. And for those people that aren't in Australia, Nick Xenophon is a oxygen thief of a politician.
You can't say that.
Hold on. Who's only in it because he wants to see his stupid face on TV all the time.
You can't say that. That's too pejorative.
He has created this.
You're not even listening.
No,
why
not
can anyone hear me?
He has created this TV advert for his party, and I can't remember what this party is called now.
The Nick Xenophon party. Funny that.
No, it's changed. Oh. He's got something else now. It is the worst thing I've ever seen. He's rapping through it. It's 1 minute and I think 40 seconds of
your life you will never get back again.
A 50-year-old man rapping.
I mean, the only 50-year-old white rapper you want to see is Eminem.
No, you don't want to see him either.
Or hear him. But that's the only one. You can't have... Anyway,
you had a fairly strong view about this, didn't you, Pat? Funnily enough.
settle back. Settle back.
Here we go.
Settle back and we can have a bit of a conversation about this. It is quite possibly not only the worst political ad, it is the worst ad of all time. And that isn't saying things lightly. For the listeners out there, Xenophon spends a fair bit of his time rapping with his hands in front of his chest in a tight-fitting black shirt, which exposes or emphasizes his man boobs. Mm. And the way he's holding his hands, it looks like he's about to cup his man boobs as he jiggles from side to side. It is truly, truly offensive. But leaving aside the negative aesthetics,
we'll put it on our Instagram feed as well for everyone's benefit later on, so they can all see him jiggling his man boobs.
We need to spread the pain, I think, to ease the pain. But one of the things, and I come at this from a political journalist's perspective, if you're trying to attract serious numbers of votes, you don't do an ad like this.
No.
Regardless, the people that are going to vote for you, and from what I could see, they're all fat white people in the ad, so that's the only crowd that he's going for. They might think it's funny, but they're not going to vote for you. Regardless of the politicians that we see in the media, the punters out there, I think, want something serious from their politicians. They don't want this sort of jiggery pokery, man boobery buffoonery.
Oh, wow. You thought that up earlier, didn't you?
No, I haven't. That's just come to me.
Is that off the top of your head?
That is how clever I am. I can do this from a standing start.
I love Simon how Pat said, oh, you're being too harsh. But, of course, now Pat is being exactly that.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm not.
Oh, sorry, you're being honest. You're being honest.
I'm not being harsh on the, because Simon doesn't agree with Xenophon's politics.
No.
He makes it personal.
No, I don't.
Yes.
Well, let's not start getting into the politics thing, but.
No. But you know what? You'll have to put this. The thing is, once people who are listening to this and then type in Nick Xenophon and hit on this YouTube clip, if it reaches a certain amount of hits, he's going to get money from this, and it's really sad on that true. Point. But the other point is, it is true. When you actually listen, if you can get past his disgraceful rap behaviour, his messages, his key messages that he is actually trying to get through to the audience, if you can get over, laughing so much, they're actually quite solid because a lot of people leave Adelaide, young people leave Adelaide. So as much as I agree with you, I think it's the worst ad in history, Pat. I totally agree. But when you look at his key messages, he has actually been thoughtful in his words.
No. It's all well and good to pretend that he's got a message.
Well, you won't get through the first 10 simply, seconds, though.
Sorry, you've made a erroneous point and I just need to rebut it. So it's all well and good to claim, as you have, Dr. Ed, that, or Mr. Ed.
That's a horse.
Whichever.
That is a horse, of course. To say that he has got a message, but I don't think he has got a message. I don't think, and he certainly hasn't conveyed what he thinks his message is in a clever or thoughtful or an inspiring way.
It's totally
he's done it. He's done it because who knows why he has done it. But it is truly, truly awful. And it just doesn't achieve anything.
I tell you, I'm not getting into the politics of it, but I tell you what frustrates me, aside from the fact that he just wants his smug face on TV all of the time.
See, there we go.
The problem I have with Nick Xenophon and the Xenophon party, and it's SA Best is this new thing he's going on about, is when you do actually listen to the policies, it's a regurgitation of bog standard policies from any politician anywhere
in
Australia.
We're going to stop young people moving away. It's motherhood stuff. We're going to stop young people moving away. We're going to stop skyrocketing electricity prices. Yeah. How are you going to do it?
And actually, Pat, because I watched a video today, but the LNP up here are peddling exactly the same thing. It's like,
so does Labor. Absolutely. Labor and the LNP. All persuasions of politicians say exactly
more
the
jobs,
same thing. Don't even start me on Pauline Hanson. We've got to stop immigration. We've got to do this. Why do we have to do this? And then they use this tried and trusted codswallop where they say this is what most Australians want. How do you know? Have you asked each and every Australian? It's just the level of political discourse in this country is at rock bottom, and Nick Xenophon has taken it down
to even further below
rock bottom levels. It's a ridiculous thing. The only thing that I can say positive about it is he might have got a bit of free advertising. Yeah. Because people like us are talking to it to our millions of podcast listeners who will now go and look at it.
So tell us your ad this week, Pat.
Oh, mine? I really, and I don't want to continue the negative theme, but I cannot abide the Chemist Warehouse ads.
Is that's not the one that goes out that's done to the Madness Our House theme tune?
No, it is definitely not done to any popular music. A woman pops up and says some stuff, and then they have the stuff that's advertised, and then it finishes with this thing that drives me up the wall, so much so that I'm starting to have dreams about it. Live well, whatever it is, and it is infuriating, and it must be as cheap as chips to make, And the only reason I know that it's on is because I watch SBS On Demand for my Nordic noir, and it pops up every occasionally in that one.
There's not a lot of good. It's a very competitive market, that Discount Chemist Warehouse.
And I get that. But and this is what I was going to ask the pair of you, who have greater experience in the advertising world than I do. Do people, does it run because it's cheap, or does it actually achieve something in getting people to buy stuff?
It is I'll let Eddie have a go at that in a second, but in my mind, those TV adverts are the equivalent of you getting one of those brochures in your catalogues, in your news, in your letterbox every week. It's just, here's information about low prices on something. And there is a certain demographic in the marketplace that's all they want. They are price hunting. They are buying the cheapest products that they can. That's what they appeal to. They're not necessarily going for the brand conscious, people don't care about good service. They just want to go in and get something cheap off a rack and take it away. So it has its space.
Yes.
And the Rugs a Million are the same, and Harvey Norman are the same.
Yes.
Here's something cheap. You've got a limited time to buy it. Come in. That's the end of it. And Rivers was the other one I always used to. Yes. Rivers did the same thing.
What you're saying in terms of that sort of generic advertising, but it doesn't, none of what we've talked about in terms of bad ads comes anywhere close to the Dove's racist ad. Remember that?
I suppose that's
a specific brand doing something very, very stupid. But
I think that's more stupid than intentionally annoying, isn't it?
Yes. I can only describe the Chemist Warehouse one as intentionally annoying. That is a very good expression to use, Simon. And it's not even clever like, remember Mrs. Marsh and the chalk? You might not, Simon, since your pedigree is from
too
the
young.
Too English, I think you find the word is that you're looking for. But Ed and I'd remember, I'm sure Ed would remember Mrs. Marsh and the chalk and the Colgate ad. It gets in.
It does get in, Pat. It certainly does. And it was an amazing ad campaign for Colgate back then. Yeah.
Anyway, so what have you got for us this week, Ed?
Well, it was very hard picking my best and worst, but my worst is the Pepsi Kendall Jenner 2017 campaign that I'm sure everyone will remember, the Live for Now moments. And basically the gist of the campaign, the overall strategy, was about uniting and joining the conversation. But the conversation that it promoted, unfortunately, was not good for Pepsi. The ad, just to refresh everyone's memory, which I'm sure everyone remembers, but it was a very long ad. It was 2:30, and Kendall's doing a shoot, and then she joins a protest and supposedly bringing everyone together, handing a policeman a Pepsi. And Pepsi thought the message was clear, but unfortunately, all of the women's demonstrations and marches on Trump Tower at the same time, the Black Lives Matter protests, and the answer to all of these was, all we needed was a soda. Yeah. Awesome. So, of course, the internet, it just totally erupted.
Explodes.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was so sad because it really trivialized the social justice movements. And Pepsi are still paying for it. I don't know. Did you guys remember that campaign last year? Were you talking about this?
Me personally, I have no memory of it at all. Because basically we don't watch free-to-air TV and it wasn't on SBS On Demand. I have read about it, absolutely.
I think it also was targeted in areas that perhaps wasn't our demographic, Pat, in the sense that we were probably too old to, to be Pepsi, on a channel that it would be showing on.
Because they target millennials in most cases, Pepsi and Coke. So it was just a very disrespectful campaign that, these guys spent hundreds or millions of dollars on this campaign and even they briefed Kendall Jenner who is, you know, the millennials sort of goddess or one of them, and they briefed her and said, you know, everything's going to be fine, this is going to be great. But it was very disrespectful to people who have suffered and sacrificed for change, and this is a thing that really Pepsi overlooked.
I guess this is one of those ones where, again, did Pepsi get more coverage out of it by it being a stinker of an ad than they would have done just running the ad on its own? So, you know, there seems to be this kind of continuing theme, Dove, Pepsi, so on and so forth, about brands that are not I hasten to use the word deliberately, but I can't believe that a lot of them are as stupid as they would appear to be. And
I totally agree with you.
They know that the 24-hour news cycle will give them a massive boost and then it will all blow over. So,
but that's not I can't believe that they were deliberately set out to do that.
Well, I do.
You can't – some of these I don't think you can explain any other way, really.
But people
But does that mean that the creatives sit down and go – I, you know what? This is going to make our brand look stupid. It's going to make our brand. It's going to threaten our brand, because, as we heard Ed say, in terms of the Pepsi stuff, that saw them suffer. But I can't believe that they would deliberately go out there to effectively tarnish their brand in the hope of getting a bit of free publicity.
I think you need to look at the specific category, the specific target market that was appealing to, i.e. people who give a shit about Kendall Jenner, which is not many people, but there is a target market that do, and ask them what they felt. Because
So you think that would be a different response to the vast majority of people who thought it was in poor taste?
I think if you sat there and found someone that said, oh my God, I love Kendall Jenner,
that's right,
then they would have gone, and I'm going to drink Pepsi now because of it.
Wow.
So, you know,
whereas
that
older,
is extraordinary.
Yeah, whereas an older demographic, they were the ones on Twitter, they were the ones going, how disrespectful are you? Because they remember the Black Riots, they remember Martin Luther King, they remember, you know, like a lot of the old stuff that went on. And so, yeah, totally the younger generation who did not remember or know, you know, people don't know what they don't know. So,
yeah. Anyway. Thank you very much, guys, for this week. And
I can't believe. Can I be the good one once?
What do you want? Well, you look. You've got complete free reign to bring whatever you want to this segment.
No. Like when you introduce us.
Oh.
Like Ed's always the good, the clever, the brilliant one. I'm always sort of at the bottom of the pile.
Yeah, but
can I be the good one once?
Wouldn't it be funny doing it the other way around? And to be fair,
I've got to tell you, it's not funny for me.
To be fair, Ed took quite a bit of stick in that last episode.
Yes, but there's a perfectly good reason.
I think I take stick in most episodes, don't I?
Yeah, there is. I can't believe QUT on Twitter were actually sharing that episode. That's what blew me away.
Well, I had to go and speak to the Chancellor on her behalf.
Oh, what, the new lady? Lovely. I hear she's
I'm sure the Chancellor of QUT would allow me entrance to plead the case for her staff. You know, I nearly said something that might not have.
I hear she's wonderful, and she would be very open to chatting to anyone.
Oh, there you go. Anyway, guys, that's it for today. Thank you very much. We'll see you both next week.
Hooray!
I am with Rachel Service, who is my guest today in my interview. Rachel is the owner of a company called the Happiness Concierge, which sounds a very, very happy company, which is, I guess, why it's called what it's called. The Happiness Concierge. Am I saying that right now?
Yeah, Rachel? That's perfect. Yeah. Okay, perfect. Cool.
They're a training company which help people ace work and life. And you've worked with some very big names, big corporate names here, including the Reserve Bank of Australia, Vanguard Investments, and the University of New South Wales. So welcome, Rachel.
Thanks for having me, Simon. Great intro. You're
did
a natural.
Is there anything else that you need to kind of just, you know, Jimmy in there, just to sort of explain who you are for everybody?
I think you've done an awesome job. Yeah, okay. We're a kick-ass training company, and I think I'd hire you to be my next MC. Thanks so much, Simon.
No, I've got a face for radio. That's why I'm here.
Plenty of strengths. I like that about you.
And you're originally a Kiwi, aren't you? Because I just want to get that out of the way straight away.
Is this going to be a problem? Because
not for originally someone from England. No, but it may be for some of the Australians out there. But
you know what, Simon? What you and I share is a love of self-deprecating humour, and that's something I love about the Brits. And cheers for the shout out.
And you know what? That's one thing I've found that the Australians can't do well. So apologies to all the Australians listening, because there are a lot of them, but I don't think they've ever managed to get that self-deprecating humour at all.
Do you know what it is? I wonder if it's that sense of inner, oh my gosh, imposter syndrome, you know, everybody knows each other in New Zealand. You think, well, I can't really bullshit because somebody's going to know my dad or my mum or my sister, you know? They're going to find out about me. So, just go straight to it.
Maybe that's it. Okay, so what I normally do here is I'm going to try and take you through a tour of your life. It makes it sound like an episode of This Is Your Life or something like that. But ooh. I actually kind of want to understand. The first question I normally ask is, what was your first job? What was the first time you got paid to do something?
I was a dishwasher at the age of 15. And right. It was my job to scrub off fat from the oven pans in the cafe in Silver Stream in Upper Hutt in Wellington, New Zealand. And my shift was from 5 p.m. to 11 p.m. And I made my mum and dad pick me up at the end of every shift. And I think I earned about $8 an hour. And that taught me about the meaning of hard work, let me tell you that.
Wow, I was going to say 6 hours of washing dishes for a 15-year-old.
That's a glamorous life. And you know what? Because as you know, I've never met a microphone that I didn't like. My goal was to get at the front of house and get talking to customers, but I thought if I worked my way up, I'd charm the chef and charm the front of house, and, you know, if someone got sick, I'd be right there. So I used to interview, or, you know, pretend I'm interviewing, ask the front of house, how do you do that coffee? How do you do that milk? How come that customer came in? What are you doing there, chef? So then they would share their intel, and then I'd be ready to roll. That was my plan.
Did the plan work?
Thank you, it did. Thank you, it did. And I was soon earning, I believe, $12 an hour.
Wow.
As a waitress, front of house. So, look, it was a fast route to the top, and I'm glad that I could get there.
is that one of those sort of jobs that you look back on and go, that you actually learnt something from? I mean, do you sort of look at it fondly or just go, well, that was a waste of my time? And
100%. My biggest lessons for Happiness Concierge have been inspired by retail and hospitality. I think hospitality do customer service exceptionally well and make everybody feel psychologically safe and welcome and valued and important, no matter what they're after. And I think hospitality professionals do a great job of going, okay, someone's on a date, do not disturb, versus someone who's perhaps alone and needs something to read. It taught me a lot about reading body language. And hey, like I was 15, 16, I probably got a lot wrong a lot of times, but one of the best jobs I've ever done. And you know what? I would send my trainers to work at a cafe or retail store to learn the basics if they were ever unsure.
Give me an example of something that you've learned sort of body language wise that you perhaps still stays with you today.
Yeah. Okay. So in the cafe, do you mean?
Yeah. Well, anywhere in those early days.
Yeah. So a good example is if someone would come in for a coffee on a Sunday and they're sitting by themselves, right? And this is before smartphones. So they'd have a newspaper and they'd be by themselves, or they wouldn't have a newspaper. And I was thinking, if I'm by myself, I want to look like I'm comfortable. I'm going to give them three options of newspapers or magazines. And often the younger version of me made an assumption that, oh, they're alone. They'd like to have a chat. Fuck no. They've got half an hour before they have to pick up the kids from soccer or whatever. So I learned very quickly around gentle, like, hey, are you giving people options? And that's what I do in the classrooms today. Hey, do you need some help there? Are you all good, mate? And they'll sometimes give me a look like, oh, piss off. And I'm like, yeah, awesome, great, you're good. Good one. Good to chat.
Are you teaching staff to ask me how my Saturday's going? Because if you are, can you stop teaching them to ask me how my Saturday's going? Because I really don't want to describe how my Saturday's going to the staff.
Do you want a bit of Simon time on the weekends?
I just don't want anyone to talk to me in a store until I'm ready to talk to them. Do you think that's, I mean, we're jumping about here, but do you think that's, do you think potentially that, you know, retail can over-service people in that way?
I think there's an opportunity for retail, put it that way. Okay. I cannot describe the amount of times where I've been in a retail store, where I've felt overlooked, a lost sale, a lost opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, I've gone in and said, hey, you know, I'd love this and this, and I might hear things like, we don't actually have your signs, or you were going to have to go to the other department, that's not my department. And that's given me a lot of inspiration for having this concierge in terms of, this is why people are afraid of sales, because I think it's sleazy and disingenuous. I think in Australia and New Zealand particularly, we can do a better job of going, hey, there's a difference between being sleazy and disingenuous and being genuinely like, hey, do you need a hand there? Are you all good? Cool, I'll leave you to it. The middle ground, for sure.
It's a very fine line, because I can go into a store and find that there's no help whatsoever. And then I go into another store and it's way too much help, and you feel bombarded. And it's really hard, especially when it's an hourly paid member of staff who might just be working on Saturday. It's hard for them to get that right, do you think?
100%. And when I do trainer boot camps for people who want to become happiness concierge trainers, and we teach them about four archetypes of people with the body language and kind of tone of voice and phrases that they say, you know, the best negotiators in the world say, get other people to talk first and they will tell you what's important to them, and then become a chameleon who responds to that. Mm. So, yeah, I think it's a huge opportunity in retail. Having said that, individuals who don't love people are probably not going to have a great career in retail. Does Australia value retail like the Europeans do? Maybe, maybe not.
Well, I don't know. That's a good question, actually. I think, yeah, that's put me on the spot there. Normally I put everybody else on the spot asking questions like that.
Put it this way, if I want to go have an amazing shopping experience and get rid of all money known to me, I'll go straight to Tokyo. You walk in, masamase, welcome to my shop. Can I take your bag? Would you like me to put this in the changing room? You know what, I'm going to take it off the coat hanger. Is there anything else you need? Great, here's the bags from the other shop, your competitor, so you can shop with two hands free. Yeah. And then you leave and they thank you. I literally have to go to the other side of the world to get that kind of service. But that, as a business person, I say, how can I give that experience to people who come into my classroom, our classroom, and say, I feel important, I feel valued, and I feel validated, and have them feeling better about themselves after a short interaction? That's what happiness concierges do, and that's what I train people to do.
Going back to some of those earlier jobs, because when you look at your LinkedIn profile, and I don't know how accurate this is, because I've had many people on this show confessing that they've made most of it up on their profile, but I'm sure yours is absolutely 100% true. You've had quite a background in that sort of comms and PR and media and those sort of things. Is that sort of an area that you still enjoy, or
what's the question you really want to ask, Simon?
It seems like you kind of jumped about a lot.
I absolutely fucking did.
I mean, so one minute you're doing fashion, then the next minute you're doing chamber music, then the next minute you're doing special effects. That doesn't kind of, I mean, I guess it's all communications, but, you know, how did you jump around like that? Was that intentional, or?
I'm so glad you asked that. Absolutely not intentional. Yeah.
Or did you keep getting fired or something?
Great question. So for somebody like me, what I learn about myself, and isn't hindsight a wonderful thing, I'll go a million miles an hour for the first 6 months.
Right.
Million miles an hour and burn myself out to the ground. And in my 20s, I burnt myself out, anxiety, depression, panic attacks, you know, passing out before work, because I literally thought work was everything. And so, you know, it came to a point where the 20-year-old version of me would go 100 miles an hour and think, oh, why do I feel so tired and bored now? I've figured it all out.
Mm.
And I think that's a bit naive when you're 20 in your 20s, but I think that's pretty accurate, yeah.
Talk to me, what's going through your head when you're doing it? Because lots of people struggle to switch off when they're running a business. And, you know, and that's from CEOs of, you know, as you would know, CEOs of massive companies down to small business who might have one or two employees. What's going through your head when you think that work is your life?
It's a question of identity. If I as an individual, put my self-worth in terms of how much output I give. If that output opportunity goes away, then my identity goes away.
Right.
So at Happiness Concierge, I'll talk to high-performing males and females, people all through the spectrum across North America, Australia, New Zealand, and Singapore, right? And the common theme where bad behaviour becomes a challenge is for, generally speaking, women, when they do not feel recognised or valued, or they feel undermined, especially publicly.
Yeah.
And for men is when you take away their financial livelihood,
right,
generally speaking. For me, as a 20-something-year-old, I had ambition, I had drive, I had the fancy suit. And truth be told, I had no idea who I was without work.
Yeah.
If you take work away, I just thought I was a failure. And that's what I used to tell myself. I'm a failure if I don't send this email.
What in your past, from cleaning the dishes at 15 to getting yourself in that sort of situation in your early 20s, what made that happen? What gave you that kind of sense of that work was your identity?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I've spent a few years in therapy trying to figure it out, to be honest. I think a lot of it was self-inflicted. I came, as a grown up around four other siblings,
right,
a loving home, an incredibly supportive home. My dad is a salesman. I think that's where I get my sales charm from. My mum's an academic, a teacher. I think that's where I get that studious thought from.
Hmm.
And so I've always loved work.
Yeah.
And so what had happened when I look back in those 20s, I taught myself into a job as a sales rep at a place that later went bankrupt. And I had no idea what I was selling. I was just like, yep, sounds great. And then I kept talking myself into communications roles and just overdoing it because I was seeking approval. I was worried about, I didn't want to say no to be seen as a failure. And because I was hitting the ground running, I gave off a perception, again in hindsight, that I had my shit together. Why would you need to manage her? She's sorted. And then I was crying in the loo, hyperventilating. How am I going to get this all done? I had a lot of friends and all that, but I actually felt really lonely, but not yet self-aware enough to say, I reckon this might be a problem.
Do you think it was almost like a form of addiction in that respect?
100%.
Yeah.
And now looking back, I've read literature which indicates that one gets addicted to the feeling of adrenaline. And when that adrenaline goes away, it's like coming off a drug. You feel depressed, lonely, isolated. And contributing to that was the fact that because work was my number one priority, I'd neglected interpersonal relationships, ongoing learning, and any of those mental health 101 checklists to keep yourself sane when you're feeling like life's getting quite busy.
Yeah, yeah. If someone's listening to this and they kind of feel that same sort of thing, aside from emailing you and asking for the advice, what's the one thing that they could do that would perhaps kind of, give them a bit of space and a chance to sort of gather themselves together?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with the language around give yourself some space. You are not alone. You are not alone in feeling like this. Most people are faking it and have heaps of anxiety behind the scenes. For me to make any change, I needed to hit rock bottom. I needed to pass out in the shower before work, or I couldn't stand up one Sunday. I think for individuals who are on the edge of their competency or edge of anxiety and having a little bit of panic, getting comfortable saying to your intimate partner or your friend and a therapist or a GP, hey, I'm not feeling so shit hot right now. Can I tell you about it? And after that, and I reckon it will come out fine, but even admitting that often to your intimate partner or your friends, that can come a lot of shame. And for me, my first step was going to a GP saying, hey, I'm not depressed or anything, but I'm kind of crying every day. Do you have a pill for that?
That's
great. Can you just fill in this little form saying on a scale from 1 to 10, how often you feel like, what's the point? And I was like, what is the point of this essay? Oh, my God. I'm just a self-obsessed 20-something-year-old. Yeah. It was very eye-opening.
And I guess I think one of the things you touched on earlier is that these kind of things affect are caused different ways between men and women and affect them in different ways. The outcomes affect them with differently men and women as well. And, I guess having seen this a couple of times myself in the past few years, that with men, often it leads to a very, very tragic ending.
100%. Studies prove time and time again, the most vulnerable time for people ending their lives are usually men who are much older, sometimes socially isolated, if they've lost their job, if they've gone through a divorce or lost their partner. Because again, these studies are finding that women are more likely to create social networks during the time of great change. And again, young men as well. I get quite a few men seeking a one-on-one saying, hey, Rach, you know, when you shared your story, of course I couldn't say anything in my three-piece suit on level 39 of whatever fancy building we were, you know, had that seminar in. But I'm just wondering, is feeling this way normal? Because I reckon maybe not. Not that I'm not coping, though.
Yeah, men papering over the cracks, you know.
And that tells me a lot about toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's no good for nobody.
Well, it's funny. Like, it brings back a memory of a guy I used to play rugby with years and years ago when I used to live back in the UK. So this would have been when I moved here in 2003. So, you know, we're talking at least 15, 16 years ago. And he killed himself. He killed himself last year. I'll say that and get the expression of the way I say that correctly. He was in his, you know, mid-50s. But he had that. It was funny because he had that social network. He played rugby with guys, with groups of guys. He had a family. And instead of losing his job, he'd actually voluntarily retired. You know, he'd made his money and retired. And it's a tragic ending that you know, that sort of happens to people in the end. It's, you know, horrible, horrible thing to think of.
It's interesting. I'm so sorry to hear that. It's very sobering to know that so many people's lives have been affected by this issue. And interesting to see that with that individual making a voluntary redundancy, whether anyone really knows who they are without work.
Absolutely. Yeah. My understanding, you know, and I hadn't been in contact with him for a long time before it happened, but that he'd been very, very successful in business and decided that it was time to retire and spend more time with the family. But that sadly is completely the opposite of what actually happened. So, anyway, we'll sort of move on with some more positive things.
I think I want to say the more we talk about this stuff, the more
absolutely.
It's a positive thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. You know, and experiencing, seeing guys, I it's one of those things that it's very hard to explain to women sometimes that guys just do not communicate. They don't get these things out to them, to their partners, to their friends, their family. And sometimes sitting over a beer, they still don't say anything. It's amazing how much that men are reluctant to share for fear of whatever the fear may be, you know, weakness or, you know, that kind of thing.
What's your take on it? With women talking to women, I think that's an awesome space for support and empowerment and tactics. Men talking to men, I think that it can only promote positive sharing of experiences. Men talking to women, that's where real change happens. Help a sister out. What's happening when men are talking to men? And for the listeners out there?
It's a good question. I mean, I wouldn't claim to have a large network of very, very close friends. I have male friends, people that I've played football with, people that I've played rugby with, people that are not connected to any of those people I went to university with. But, you know, do you sort of discuss your deep down kind of fears and, you know, problems with them? Probably not. It's still that sort of top level, you know, friendship where you discuss football games or the last TV show that you've been watching or that sort of thing. It's hard for guys to get beyond that sort of top level of discussion. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I suppose an observation I'm making is being socialized from a young age, like, yeah, get your feelings out. Like, let's talk about this. I'm going to support you. For me, that's a natural progression based on my gender and socialization and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
For you, I'm interested in the cues that people of your demographic are getting at every stage. So then to say and sit around your mates and have a beer and watch the footy, hey, so not feeling so good. That's going from 1 to 1,000. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
The question I have is, yeah, like what could be a gateway drug, for lack of a better analogy? And so the language that I use in boardrooms, if I'm working with all men or mixed groups, are often sporting analogies and behavior, calling behaviors a color as opposed to a feeling. When you tell, when you put your hand on the desk and go, get the fuck out of my boardroom, and wondering why your team's a bit scared of you, I reckon we should talk about what's going on behind the scenes. And hey, not pointing any fingers here.
Interesting. We could go off on this. I was going to say we could go off on this very, very, in a very deep conversation. We'll come back to it again. We'll come back to it later on. But there was a question I wanted to ask you about something that happened that I saw you doing at a certain time. And I'm going to pick this time, 2000.
Oh, God.
No, don't worry. It's not that bad. 2009. Because that late 2010s, was. And I've talked about this with other guests as well, it was quite a watershed time when it came to social media. You know, Facebook was new, there was other platforms, the iPhone wasn't, you know, just out in the wild and things like that. And you were doing quite a bit of mobile and social media work. How did you find those networks back in those early days?
Yeah, it was a funny time. I'm 36 now. Math isn't my forte. Let's see. However old I was in London, and I told everyone I was going to move to Germany to become, you know, a pop singer. And then I got to Germany. I was like, oh, far out. They all speak German here. Yeah. It's quite cold. They're quite literal. Yeah. And I'm quite, you know, camp and over the top and all that. And so I went to London for seek of employment, and as soon as I got off the train, I heard things like, you're right, darling. I was like, oh, you're right. Yeah, I love it. Like, it was all about that life. And so I hustled like a maniac, and recruiters would say, look, this alleged New Zealand you speak of, yeah. So that experience doesn't mean much over here. And also it's a global financial crisis, so unless you're a citizen or you can find someone to marry in the next 2 weeks, no deal.
Yeah.
And all my friends who were in London were being made redundant. And I was like, well, I've kind of told everyone I'm in London, so I better make this work. And so I went door knocking, and one of those doors I knocked on was an agency, which I think is now defunct, working with an absolute rock star called Tom Ollerton. And I sat down opposite him, and he was like, yeah, look, this experience, inverted commas, this doesn't really mean anything to me. This is a job I can give you, and it's ready now. It's starting at the top, and that's as an intern working on the social media strategy for a equestrian firm they're working with.
Right.
And I was like, by that stage, just really like exhausted and tired and broken. I was like, fine.
Give me a job.
I'll take it. And I was a waitress in the evenings at a bowling alley. Yeah. And I don't really know what the social media was. I think MySpace was a thing back then.
I was going to say 2009. What does the social media strategy look like in 2009?
Well, of course, I had no idea. And he said, well, you've got 48 hours to figure it out. Here's the brief. And I think what I really loved about Tom, I identified working with him. He is someone who brought out the best of me in a short amount of time, because he saw that hunger and rewarded that and was able to let me work autonomously.
Yeah.
And with the social media stuff, I remember saying things like, cool, so what? Huh? What? And I was like, all right, well, let's figure it out. All right, so it needs to be a social media strategy. This is the opportunity for the client. This is what we can do. How can we build community? Let's break it down. And so, yeah, it was around building communities. And I thought, oh, well, this makes sense. This is like relating to people, but online. I could figure that out.
Yeah.
And that way of I could figure it out is how I ended up in so many of these jobs. You know what I mean? And that's still what I teach trainers today. Say yes, we can figure it out.
Yeah. And it sounds like that social media strategy hasn't changed a great deal in 10 odd years. It's still the same thing. It's about building communities and, you know, people that are interested in the same thing that you're interested in.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of my students are content marketers and strategists, and insert buzzword here. At the end of the day, my belief is people take a second look at you through emotion, and they buy on logic and credibility. So that's what I look to create through Happiness Concierge social media. Strategy, I don't have one. If people feel an emotion when they see any touch point related to Happiness Concierge through the use of expensive photography, we will do that.
Mm.
Yeah. Remove any risk and get people to feel an emotion when they see you, and that's something they'll remember and repeat.
It's always tough for those smaller businesses because it's all well and good us saying, you know, you've got to create these emotions to pull people in. And that's when you're a small business and you've got, you know, three or four employees, that's really hard. What do you suggest to people in those kind of situations?
Is creating an emotion around your product or service hard, or the execution?
I think for some businesses, it's both. Mm. I think, I always pick on accountants in this podcast because
accountants. I love accountants.
Because I feel they have the hardest job trying to create some sort of emotional, tangible engagement with an end user when all they're doing is counting numbers or chasing invoices. So,
oh, they're saving lives. They're reducing anxiety. They're making your life easier. How can that not be an emotional experience?
But absolutely. But at the same time, you're talking about an accountant who's very much, you know, one side of the brain, and you're asking them to talk about themselves with the other side of the brain, which for a lot of them is a big challenge.
Absolutely. And part of the reason why Happiness Concierge teaches charisma classes is because technically minded experts are sensational at the tools. That's, and right. People like me are not sensational at those kind of tools. So let's share the knowledge 100%.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
In terms of conveying emotion, people hire, promote and refer people they like who they feel that they're buying the real version of themselves.
Yeah.
There's 100 training companies and there are 100 accountants, thousands, millions. Are you someone, especially around that nature of work, people can trust? Do you make others feel good and in control of their finances? And are they likely to recommend you to a friend? There is no budget on content or social media that you could spend that will replace an experience someone has with you when they talk to you and see you and believe that they can trust you.
You made a statement earlier on about, you know, take the job and figure it out as you go on. Has that been the fake it till you make it motto for you on the way through?
You found holes in my argument. Fake it till you make it. I don't love that. What I do love is building on knowing what you're capable of and not hesitating on an opportunity if you know that you can reach out to people who can skill you in between what you're saying now and when it's due.
Right, right.
Yeah. I encourage people to talk in the now as opposed to what I want to be one day as a happiness concierge or an accountant of my dreams. I am an accountant. This is what I can do and this is what I can figure out for you. You can trust me because you know me, you like me, you trust me, and speak to any of my clients or colleagues. You can trust me, I'll get the job done. And as I was saying to someone over breakfast yesterday, a healthy anxiety makes you perform.
Okay.
And this is one of the partners of one of the biggest firms here in Australia. A healthy anxiety makes you perform. Where it becomes dangerous, particularly for people with my history, is where their anxiety goes into panic and fear and, as I say, burning myself out. And this is a lifelong thing that I haven't entirely resolved, but they say they teach what you most need to learn.
I'm just interested to understand that a little bit more, that healthy anxiety. How do you define that? How do you know that's the space you're in, or, you know, that you haven't gone too far or that sort of thing?
I think where it becomes dangerous is when the anxiety is fueling a negative narrative to you. I'm not good enough. I don't deserve this. I'll never figure it out. I'm a failure. What am I doing? Where we can turn that into a positive narrative. I'm so grateful for this opportunity. I can't believe I've got a chance to learn more by 9 a.m. tomorrow. Tomorrow it's 10 p.m. tonight. Yeah. Turning that narrative into a positive. And I think for me, to be quite frank, I have needed sponsors to help me from stop working and reality check. So I have an advisor and I also have a workaholic sponsor, a friend of mine. He invites me around to dinner and texts me. He's like, hey, are you working? And I was like, of course I am. He's like, yeah, it's a bit off-brand. Come around for dinner.
Right, okay.
Yes. Yeah,
is that something that's helped you through having those kind of sponsors, or, I mean, you call them sponsors, would you know, coaches or those sort of things? Is that a different word or different sort of objective?
Yeah, for me, I've made a conscious effort to surround, since these three burnouts and having a moment in New York where I was like, this is ridiculous, not the life I want to have. I made a decision to prioritize relationships and building a network around me so then I could stay sane. Mm. Sane is relative, of course. So yeah, I'd made a conscious effort to do that. To be quite frank, like, it's something I struggle with every day. Mm. Even if as I'm sitting here thinking, oh, I'm looking forward to chatting with Simon, I'm still thinking like, oh, well, do I tell him that at 4 a.m. this morning I woke up in a panic figuring out how to address this brief? Well, there you go. Yeah, it's never ending. But on the flip side, I'm walking to breakfast looking up. I'm in Sydney today, yeah, looking up going, this is my dream. This is what I dream for. Let's enjoy it. Otherwise, yeah, what's the point?
Talk to me about that New York moment a little bit more, because that's obviously something that you highlight on your website as well. Where were you in New York?
So I'd spent the last – well, the catalyst for going to New York was that I'd always, you know, had this dream. I'll go to New York and own a business and wear a suit and be fabulous. You know, pretty vague version of success, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I'd broken up with my long-term partner and then – had a fling and that ended disastrously, as rebounds do.
Yep.
And then I thought, well, fuck this, you know, and took all my savings and got on a plane to New York, cried for 2 weeks in every shop in Manhattan, basically. Just shop, ate and cried, shop, ate and cried. Yeah, I remember crying in Dean and DeLuca, da-da-da. And then I booked a ticket to see the one person who I knew who could help me. It wasn't a therapist. It wasn't a GP, an acupuncturist, a natural healer. Who do you think that was?
No idea.
Beyonce. Her Royal Highness. Yeah, Beyonce. So I can hear
therapy by Beyonce
in your voice. It's kind of one of those things where you're thinking, if there's only one person who can make me feel better, that's my hero, right? So I'm in Brooklyn at the Barclay Center, I think it's called. Barclay Center, I think. And I walk in and I start crying. You know, it's an emotional moment. Yeah. I'm tired and I've spent the last 2 weeks crying, so why not? And then I'm wearing gothic makeup because I'm in, you know, like that was my look back then and my eyes are getting a bit watery. And I cried throughout the opening act. I cried throughout Beyonce, all 2 hours of her Miss Carter World Tour. And I was just howling, crying to a point where people next to me were just like, bitch, can you not? Like,
I was going to say, because if I got a ticket to Beyonce and I'd sat next to you crying the way through it, yeah, I want my money back.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, the single leg. I'm a diva. Yeah, I mean, you can imagine. And so it wasn't until I was on the subway afterwards where I had the brochure and the plastic bag and the T-shirt, and I actually looked around the subway and people were singing, you know, that post-concert vibe. And I was like, I saw my reflection and I thought, service. If you can't enjoy this,
yeah,
I reckon you might be the problem, mate. And that was a bit of an aha moment for me. So it took me 10 years, but I got there.
And what did you decide to do at that point? What was the, you know, whilst you're sitting there with runny makeup all down your face?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose the good thing is that I was so tired and self-absorbed that I didn't really notice how bad I looked.
Yeah.
But for me, it wasn't like, aha, the purpose is clear, become the happiness concierge. No. I went back to Melbourne and I thought, I've got to do something different, but I don't know what that is because I feel really shit right now.
Yeah.
And so I started to do little tools like, okay, what do I actually really want? And who in my life is actually good for me? And oh shit, what else? Oh, what do I want to achieve this year? I've got no idea. And I made little rules and lists for myself and I started a blog published to myself, and I didn't know that was connected through medium.com to my Twitter account. And a friend of mine who's a Twitterella, really into Twitter, I don't really understand Twitter, but she was on Twitter going, hey, I just want to let you know this thing about burning out and helping yourself out was quite helpful. And I thought, shit, cool. And then I was telling my friend over coffee, so I reckon I want to be a speaker. And she said, oh, what do you want to speak about? And I was like, so that's the problem that I have regarding contents. And she said, well, what about, you know, how you're telling me about Her Royal Highness Beyonce and your aha moment. I was like, would anyone want to hear about that? I mean, come on. And she said, well, you know, figure it out. And then I was talking to a friend of mine and saying I want to speak more. And he said, oh my God, I'm the MC of this event next week. I'd rather, you know, eat my own vomit than do it. Can you do it? I hate stages.
Yeah.
And that's when I heard da, 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 da in my head. I was like, this is it. And then someone in the audience said, oh, this is great. So you do this full time? And I was like, yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, definitely. And they said, great, well, can you do a course in it? Yeah, got one of those for sure.
Panic, quit, write something down.
person. And then General Assembly was like, that's great, so we'll do that, you know, in a few weeks' time. I was like, well, that's great because that exists. Cool. Because I've always loved presenting. I worked in agencies for years and client side. I always loved the new business presenting side. Yeah. And then somebody in the audience was like, hey, that was really helpful. So can you bring that to my organization? Send me your corporate rates. And I went, yeah, corporate rates, definitely have those also. And went home and called my dad and said, hey, what's a corporate rate, Dad?
Well, it's funny. We had my last masterclass that I did was about how do you price yourself. So yeah. When you rang your dad, what did he say? Just charge as much as you can possibly get away with, or?
The great thing about Dad is that he was like, Rachie, because I've called him many times over the years. I'm crying in London, I'm crying somewhere, you know. He's like, Rachie, are you all right? What's going on? And he was basically saying, okay, what are you doing? What are you proposing to do? Okay, so while you have experience, you're at the start of your journey. And I called another friend of mine who worked for a professional services firm. And she said, cool, Rach, the goal would be this price here, like the top tier. Yeah. Where you are now is day one. So use this as your case study to build up your portfolio and start from scratch, which I did. Like I was free for the first 6 months. I think my first bill was $200. I was pretty excited by that.
Yeah.
I framed that invoice. It was pretty exciting. and then worked my way up and, you know, still working my way up. You know, a mentor told me, always charge enough where you're taken seriously and charge a little bit more than that you're become quite anxious about doing a good job, but not too much that it paralyzes you and it puts your client in a position where they can't support what you're delivering.
Yeah.
And so that helped me flick the switch between what's this money for me. Instead of that, thinking about the client, what does the client need to look successful, to have visibility, and to say to their boss, hey, that was my idea bringing in Happiness Concierge. You are welcome.
How did you find clients in those early days, and how do you still find clients now? Is it all word of mouth, or, you know, is there some other channels or mechanisms of marketing that work really well for you?
Yeah, for sure. So because I'm selling a service, people need to know that they know me, like me, and trust me. So the quickest way to do that is getting in front of as many people as possible doing what I do best.
Yeah.
And that for me is in a classroom or on a stage. So I emailed everyone I knew. Do you need a speaker? Do you need any workshops? Do you need anything done? And to support that, document that. People need to see that I do this every day, every day, every day.
Yeah.
And that's why you'll see images of me and my team speaking everywhere to communicate. We are experts. We do this all the time. We're continually evolving and learning. In terms of client acquisition, if I'm doing a workshop or a talk, almost on the day, 3 months later, I'll get an email saying, hey, I know it was a while ago, but I was in this class where you talked about X. Do you reckon you could talk to our team about that? That was really helpful. Yeah. And they're selling it into their team. And then to support that, not a day or week goes by when I'm not organizing breakfasts and connecting people. And it's not a sell. It's around, hey, this is what I do, but can we take work off the table? I'm keen to learn more about you. And that's where genuine relationships are born. And then if they decide to engage Happiness Concierge, that's not something that's ever my suggestion. It's up to them because they have to believe it to sell it in.
Yeah, yeah. So many questions now. Who've you enjoyed working with the most in that? And I'm just looking at the Happiness Concierge at the moment. What organization have you been to and gone, you know, these guys have got their shit together. This is a good organization.
In terms of, do you mean a client or a partner or a supplier?
Anybody, really. Anybody that you've walked in and just been wowed with, you know, a company that you've just gone, you know, that you've been really impressed with. Or there may be nobody.
There are so many. I'm just trying to think about my confidentiality. Well, there are so many. Damn it. Yeah, there's so many.
Let me rephrase that question then. What impresses you from these companies?
Yeah.
What is it that sort of gets you excited?
That's such a good question. What really, really, really gets me excited are the moments when I turn detractors into people who realize that they have a choice around how to affect their career change. So while clients and brands bring me in, what happens is there'll always be a computer says no in the room.
Yeah.
there'll always be someone who says, oh, who the fuck is this girl? Tony Robbins wannabe, pink lipstick. You know,
singing Beyonce to us. What's going on?
Oh, fucking yawn. Yeah, and I've been to a million training programs. Yeah. And as soon as I walk in, I look for those people. And I make it my job to flip them around. So what excites me about Happiness Concierge is just finding people who have been overlooked, never validated, and put in a box and say, hey, you matter. You belong. How can you get to the next stage? Let's figure it out. And if that's a perception thing and that's you changing your behaviors, let's do that. In terms of like brands that excite me, to be really brutally honest, my biggest inspiration comes from music, hospitality, and retail.
Right.
Well, around branding and experience.
So if you were to say to me, there's things that you've seen that certain companies do, and that's impressed you, or ways that staff are treated, or things what are those? I'm kind of interested because I want people to sit there and say, you know what, my company's only got 5 staff, but you know what, I could do that as well, or I could apply that to my business.
Yeah, 100%. The things that have really excited me that I try to drill into everything we do is treat your staff like your client. Treat your staff like your client and treat your ambassadors or people who are fans of the brand that might never spend any money with you as if they're paying you $1,000 a minute.
Okay.
Is that, I'm hearing a bit of skepticism there.
No. Not skepticism. I want to understand how you do that, if that makes sense. It's great saying that, but then what behaviors does a business owner then have to implement to show that?
Yeah. For Happiness Concierge, it's about treating every individual as if like they're a rock star, basically. So for example, for my team member in Canberra, I flew to Canberra for a week, get to know his family, get to know his local coffee joint, get to know his kids, you know, go to the gym with his wife and understand their challenges. It's getting to know them as if they are partners of your business.
Yeah.
Because if they feel like partners of your business, they're more motivated to do a good job in a way that serves them.
Gotcha. Okay.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. It's more work than you'll do with your clients, I reckon, is with your people.
It's funny. Sometimes you read things that say, you know, the client's number one or the people that work for you are number one. Clearly, you believe the latter as opposed to the former.
I'm not really into like, who's number one? The client's always right. It's quite subservient and it's kind of insulting to people. Like, fuck you. Like, we need to slave away so the client's happy and we're exhausted.
Yeah.
No. I think treating people like adults and assuming that they can go and create a competitor to your business in a second. Why do they stay with you? Because they feel like they belong and they matter. Right. In terms of brands that do stuff well, Thankly, my partner for sending out thank you notes following, that I'm a big believer in, you know, thanking people for the smallest of things.
Yeah.
Thankly, they do amazing stuff. Daily Blooms. Florist of choice, online choice. Yeah, they do a great job. Are you more interested in stuff that organizations are doing too?
No, yes and no. What I'm interested in is things that have piqued your interest, your curiosity, because obviously you're out there training these businesses every day. But and I would imagine that one of the things that you see very evidently is the weaknesses in businesses and organizations. Correct. But that's why I think that when you see something that somebody's doing well, it stands out. It's probably, they're probably doing it really well if you're noticing it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think what stands out for me is when I was in San Francisco and a very, very, very large firm said to me, no investment has given us greater return than our 2-year coaching program to bring out the best in our people. If they leave after 2 years, then we've actually probably done our best job with them. Because we're continually bringing in people who are only performing in their best during that duration. Mm. And I just thought, oh, my gosh. And I was talking to someone last night in Sydney from another big tech firm, and she said the same. She said the same, like no other greater return because people feel empowered. Mm. So learning and development, HR, learning, blah, 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 blah. Make people feel, whatever you want to call it, people and culture.
Yeah.
Unless people feel valued, like... It is a lot of work. People are a lot of work. Being nice to people is hard. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's hard. Yeah. It's why it gets overlooked and not done well. And yeah, like everyone's human, like I'm going to make mistakes too.
Because they're looking, most business owners are looking for the easy option. It's now, as you say, training staff and teaching staff to be better and educating them and all that is, it's hard work. It costs money. And yes, often they don't see the immediate return on investment. It's not something that they can spend $10 on and see $100 next day.
How, and define return on investment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you put a price on employees saying to their mate over a beer in Canberra, yeah, happiness concierge, just join them. Yeah, I'm not, I mean, I thought it was a bit Tony Robbins at first myself, but oh, now I'm fucking loving it. Can I put a price on that person talking to another person who then takes that back into a massive client in Canberra?
Yeah.
I mean, that might come to fruition 5 years from now.
Last three questions for you today, which are the same last three questions that I ask everybody. Number one, what are some brands that you like that you buy often? And by that, this is different from the companies that you see, the behaviors and all those kind of things. But what's a brand that you buy all the time or shop at all the time and those kind of things?
Good one. Thankly. I use Thankly most days. Online thank you note service. The brands that excite me, Fenty Beauty by Rihanna, exceptional branding.
Okay.
Yeah, Fenty Beauty by Rihanna.
Yeah.
I think brands that excite me. I'm pretty excited, not that I purchase a lot from Uniqlo, but I love their retail experience. Love it.
Yeah, see, I've never got into that. I just don't.
You don't get it?
No.
Why?
I just find it very bland.
Oh, the clothes are, for sure, the clothes are brand. The clothes for me are irrelevant.
Yeah.
The experience, I like it.
Yeah. I don't want a great experience to then buy something bland at the end. It's, you know, I want a great experience.
I'm looking forward to being impressed by a brand in Australia and I'm open to suggestions. If I want to be impressed by a brand, I'm going to go to Tokyo.
Hmm.
The retail experience there is phenomenal and we can learn so much from what they do well.
I actually noticed on your website you've worked with, and we always argue the pronunciation of this with me and my wife, it's Lululemon.
Lululemon, yeah.
Is it Lululemon?
Does it matter?
Well, it does, because last week I corrected Patrick, who does the show at the start of the first bit of the show with this. I said to him, no, Patrick, it's Lululemon, as my wife has said. Lululemon, you're supposed to. And because he said it was Lululemon. So lemon or lemon, either way, he was actually quite impressed with the retail experience there.
Oh, it's killer. And because they invest in their team like coaches.
Yeah.
It is unbelievable. And the cool thing they do at Lululemon or Lululemon is that they go, hey, I'll put this in changing room. What was your name? And I'll say, Rachel. Thanks so much, Rachel. And they'll write your name on a whiteboard as you go into the change room and say, hey, Rach, do you need anything? Size 10, size 12? You're all good? No. Okay. Remembering your name. Yeah. When I ask people, think about a memorable retail experience you've had recently. Most people close their eyes in my sessions and open up and say, Lululemon because they remember my name, a coffee shop because they remember my name, or the Apple store because they said instead of no, but, or whoever, they say, as it turns out, we don't have what you need. What we do have, however, is insert expensive thing here. Now that's what I got, this fucking expensive phone that does face recognition. As if I need that.
I always remember that instruction about the Apple store. They're not allowed to say unfortunately, or so they're not allowed to say negative words. Everything has to be a spin on a slightly more positive outcome.
I've got these five other laptops. Yeah, awesome. And also, you know, in the supermarket, when somebody who's trained well, instead of saying, so sorry about the wait, they say, thanks so much for waiting. And you go, oh, no problem.
Yeah, look, it you make a fantastic point that just even changing two or three words in a sentence can actually have a massive difference on the impact that you have as a brand to people.
Completely, and the impact you have on other people and how likely they are to talk about you when you're not in the room when most of the decisions are made about your business.
Yeah. I just going back a couple of steps there's a a comedian routine about how to remember people's names, because I think that's a great challenge for a lot of people. And he said when someone tells you their name, you have to envisage them standing in front of a particular color house with a particular fence, and you have to describe the house in your brain, and you know, and the color of the door and what they're wearing and all those kind of things in this image. And he said, so that's one way of remembering their name. He said the second way of remembering their name is just to pay fucking attention when they tell you.
You know, a trick that I give to people is when people talk, I physically create subtitles on the frame.
Yeah.
So if we were talking face to face, I would see subtitles.
That's interesting.
Remember your fucking name. For whatever reason, because I speed read for keywords, my brain can remember that better.
Yeah. I think one of the other ones, the serious one, is that, you know, you've got to just repeat it back to them three times. So as you talk back to them, as soon as you've met them, just say their name three times and it will embed itself in you, in your brain, a little bit easier. So,
and you know what? If you want other people to remember your name, don't be interesting. Be interested in them.
Yeah, yeah. Second to last question, what is next for you? Where do you go from here? You've been doing Happiness Concierge for 3 years now. What's the plan for the business?
Yeah, pretty exciting. We've got our next trainer intake in 4 weeks in Melbourne, taking on trainers Sydney, Melbourne, Canberra based. For me, the goal is to have trainers all over Australia and, you know, looking at a succession plan for somebody else to run this. I love running a business. I'm excited to grow the Happiness Concierge brand globally. That really, really, really excites me, including training and stationary lines and all of that awesome stuff.
What's going to be your challenge getting it out of Australia?
The biggest piece of advice I was given on going to the US market and Asia Pacific on my visits there was, when looking to go global, for a CEO to run the shop in Australia and or anywhere else and then to go overseas, the cultural nuances are so subtle and so overbearing that to flick that light switch between two territories is impossible.
Yeah.
So therefore, people who can take ownership in each territory, who know the intricacies of each market. I'm a chameleon. I've adapted to Australia. Put me in New Zealand, I'll get like totally bro, dude. But in London, I'd probably be more inclined to talk a bit like this. So that over time, it benefits so much from people, in each territory. So what will stop me? Well, I suppose getting over my workaholic ways. I'm still the 19-year-old, 16-year-old washing dishes trying to do it all. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's my short-term memory is terrible, but when I spoke to Justin Dreyer from Vinomofo, joint CEO of Vinomofo, and they talked about going into other countries, he literally said, we're starting again. He said, we're starting from 100%. Absolute scratch, startup. He said, we have the benefit now of experience of having started it in one country. So he said, whilst we're starting from scratch, we can start from scratch a lot quicker. So everything that we did the first time round that might have taken 2 years doesn't necessarily need to take 2 years the next time. It could take 6 months, but we do the same things again and grow it from the ground up.
What a great phrase. You know what, Simon, that gives me hope and I'm grateful for that.
Cool. Blimey, I've achieved something today. All right, my last question. If people want to get in contact with you, what's the best way to do that? If they've got some... if they want you to come and talk at an event or train their team, or they just want to vent about something that's weighing on their shoulders, because I'm sure you need lots of people emailing you about that, but, you know.
Three ways. The quickest way, rachel@happinessconcierge.com. The keen to find out more way, happinessconcierge.com. And for those who are keen to join the free Slack community to talk about all things possible, happinessconcierge.com/network.
There's a Slack community. How are you finding Slack?
I fucking love it.
Do you?
I love it. I was skeptical at first. I thought another messaging platform, really? And what I've discovered is, as they say in Stanford, it's not what you say your brand is, it's what your community or users say your brand is. Yeah. So I started this community. I thought I'd give it a go, try it out. I tried Slack for a few weeks myself with my trainers.
Yeah.
And I set it up. Who wants it? And then now it is popping. It is popping in the most popular channel or thread. I'm still getting used to the terminology. Is the job opportunities which are not advertised.
Oh, interesting.
That tells me a lot about my network.
How many people have you got in the Slack on Slack now?
100.
Okay, cool.
Launched a few weeks ago. So, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, we'd better check that out.
I look forward to it.
Thank you very much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure and highly entertaining, as I figured it probably would be. Anything else that you'd kind of want to just shove in there right at the end, just as a sort of a final lesson for people?
I suppose the lesson would be, if you're working so hard on building your business or CEO or being the leader or managing other people, don't forget to enjoy the ride.
Wonderful. Finally, thanks very much again for your time today, Rachel. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here.
Simon, it's been a privilege and an honor. Thank you so much.
Once again, thank you very much for listening to the Simon Dell Show. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you took some lessons and some interesting stories away from Rachel's interview. What I will say is I want you to go back and listen to Rachel's interview. And I want you to go and do it for one reason, is that I want you to go back and listen to it and count the amount of times that she says her company name, the Happiness Concierge. And you will not actually believe how many times she said it. And I didn't say this at the start of the podcast because I thought if I say it at the start of the podcast, everybody's going to get completely distracted with the amount of times that she's saying it on the way through. But now you've got to the end, now you can go back and you can actually sit there and go, Jesus, she's saying that a lot. So good on her for reinforcing the brand all the way through. Hats off for even remembering to do that. So I hope you enjoyed it. As I say, remember to rate and review us. Please get in contact with me. And we look forward to hearing from you and seeing you next week. Thanks very much.